You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and facts are liberal. Here's Chuck Todd. This was an interview that was then played on Fox News. In fact, this clip is from Fox News, where in this this segment, these five people, I think, where they're sitting around making fun of the idea that there's no liberal bias in the media. So they played this Chuck Todd clip to tear apart. Here it is.
I think that the mythology of the big bad non-conservative media has gotten into some offices, and so that there's this fear of, well, we can't do anything that's not. It's sort of this, and I feel like it's a mythology that now younger staffers believe, and then it infuses, and then these guys, they actually believe the spin that's out there. Oh my God, that's what the mainstream media does. They do anything to disrupt the conservative agenda. The mythology that the media is out to get conservatives is believed among more and more actual staffers.
Staffers, congressional staffers, I'm assuming he was talking about. Or was it media staffers? Media staffers. Interesting. So the media is more and more self-censoring with regard to this. Fascinating stuff. So, you know, let's talk media with a guy in the media, John Fugelsang, an actor, comedian, host of Viewpoint on Current TV. His website, johnfugelsang.com. One of the best, by the way, one of the best stand-up comics I've ever seen in my life, John Fugelsang. Great to have you on the program, John. Thanks for joining us today.
Wow, Tom Hartman, praise from you. That means something in my
book. But it's true. You know, I've seen your act. You blow my mind. You're so smart and you're so fast. Here's the thing that boggles my mind, aside from the fact that Chuck Todd is worried that maybe people on his own staff are saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, what about this liberal bias, is what is liberal about believing in evolution? What is liberal about pointing out that literally hundreds of studies, the Equality Trust in the UK, equalitytrust.org.uk, lays all this stuff out, Wilkerson and Pickett in their book, The Spirit Level, or Why Inequality Matters, that income inequality, wealth inequality are destructive to social cohesion and all these kind of. What's liberal about saying, you know, we've got a gun problem? What's liberal about global warming? What's liberal about acknowledging racism? What's liberal about acknowledging that the banksters and the rich pay a maximum 20% income tax rate and all the rest of us pay up to 39%, you know, if we should be lucky enough to make that kind of money? And I don't get it. It's like, what's liberal about facts? Why are facts liberal, John Fugelsang?
Well, only if you own a dictionary, Tom, and that's the thing. We've gotten away from what the word liberal actually means. You know, the media is as liberal as the corporations that own it. And what I've learned in my travels through the corporate media as a humble clown working his way through through cable news and broadcast and radio is that the media is not liberal. The media is full of people who are horrified of being called liberal. And this has led to all the false equivalency that frustrates people of sanity and conscience so much. In a true free society, in a society based on liberty, if you know what the dictionary definition is, you would want a liberal media. Liberal doesn't mean pro-democratic party. Liberal means that you're questioning authority, that you're trying to move society forward and fighting for everyone. So that, to me, is a real conservative value.
Well, and in fact, George Washington said, I hope I shall ever see America become a more liberal nation. I mean, the whole idea of being liberal came out of the Enlightenment. It came out, you know, it arguably started with Thomas Hobbes in the 1630s, and then John Locke in the 1670s, his second treatise on government, the 1680s and 90s, Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the Noble Savage, and the idea of self-government, and the idea that maybe we actually are good, and we can therefore take care of ourselves. We don't need a pope or a king or a queen to tell us exactly how to behave in every circumstance under all conditions, running our government for us. I mean, it's fine to have them out there if you want to have a constitutional monarchy or have a church, but running a government, we don't need that.
And I would even add to that, Tom, that, you know, regardless of what you believe, there's no greater liberal in history or literature than Jesus. So the greatest irony is the only way to be a conservative Christian is to be a raging liberal, which is what Jesus was.
Yeah, it's You know, there was this.
Conservative Christian is a complete oxymoron, yeah. and there's nothing conservative about believing in Genesis as literal fact. Jesus never mentioned Genesis. He talked about Genesis as much as he mentioned monster trucks.
Well, actually, he did mention it once. He said he hadn't come to destroy the old law; he'd come to fulfill it, which is arguably a way of saying we can put that behind us now.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, it was, you know, Jesus was a guy who spoke in metaphor, and it's so hard for them to take any of the Bible in metaphor. You look at Matthew 25, you know, he said what he came here for. It's about helping the poor, helping the sick, helping those in prison, and not deploying violence, you know, a pretty liberal guy by today's standards. But in reality, that's the beautiful irony is, you know, you can't be conservative Christian. It's literally an oxymoron.
And yet there is this group of people who think that it's a terrible thing to ask a millionaire to take a to be hit with a 3% increase in taxes, or even for multimillionaires and billionaires to have to pay tax rates at the same rate that, you know, the surgeon who saved my wife's life, he works for a living, right? And he's probably making a couple $100,000 a year, so he's probably paying 39%. And Mitt Romney is looking at a maximum of 20%, no matter what he does, because that's the top capital gains rate. And there's people who are saying, oh, well, we can't raise Mitt Romney's taxes. That would be wrong. You know, why should he have to pay what a surgeon makes? And then on the other hand, they say, oh, but, you know, those teachers, let's cut their pay by 20%. They're making $60,000 a year. Those, you know, that's absurd.
Well, I don't know if you watch enough Fox News, Tom Hartman, but millionaires have had it really tough in this society for a very long time. But when Mitt Romney came out in his campaign last year, and we learned that in 2010 he made, what, $20 million for not working and paid just under 14% on that income in taxes.
Right.
Whereas a middle-class person who did work for their income, didn't just live off interest, paid up to 24% or more of their income in taxes. But Mitt Romney taught us more about the 1% than Occupy Wall Street could on their best day.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm curious, John, how do you, you know, when you're engaging with people that you like and respect or love, you know, family members, friends, who call themselves Republicans or call themselves conservatives, how do you broach these issues? How do you interact with them in ways that, you know, don't leave blood on the floor?
Well, the number one way is to not be that angry, hateful liberal who gets into screaming fights. You've got to be the adult in the room. And you're never going to win them over. You can give all the facts and all the history and all the logic and all the morality in the world, but you probably won't win them over. What you will do is win over the bystanders and their kids and whoever's listening to the conversation. And that's why it's important to not get bogged down into, you know, the screeching puppet on the left versus the screeching puppet on the right. I always say I love conservative people. I don't like who they vote for.
Yeah.
And when you look at the policies of these guys, you know, the Republican Party's been running a real sucker game on conservative Americans.
Well, that's an important point, because so many Americans who consume right-wing media, who listen to Fox News, watch Fox News, listen to right-wing talk radio, read the right-wing blogosphere, they believe things that simply aren't true. So it seems to me that at a certain level, if you confront them with reality repeatedly, and then they, friends, family, if you can eventually get them to go out and test that, you know, go to Snopes or something, and that maybe they'll realize that they've been conned, that they've been suckers.
Well, sure. I mean, we're seeing this now in the Republican Party with immigration. You know, all last year we saw the Democrats trying to drive a wedge in the Republican Party over the class issue, which is a very fair and appropriate thing to do. The 47% really should have been what drove a wedge into the party. It didn't. What really did it is immigration. When these Republicans have realized you need 60% of the Latino vote to get the White House, suddenly let freedom ring, and most of us love, try and have a pathway to citizenship now. But, you know, as John McCain found out in his town hall meeting this week, when you've got a base that's been eating a steady diet of Fox News telling you about the caramel menace coming over from the border, and then you try to use language like pathway to citizenship, I mean, that town hall, McCain was heckled and insulted, verbally abused so rudely by people who used to support him.
Yeah, people who
have, to make sure he wasn't Chuck Hagel.
People who've spent years, you know, watching Lou Dobbs, tragically. John Fugelsang, johnfugelsang.com. Thanks, John.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do you have these conversations? I mean, you know how I do. I do this every day. How do you have conversations with conservatives in your home? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. How do you talk to liberals? How do you talk to conservatives in your home? By the way, before I pick up your calls on this, I'll just say, my guiding principle when debating people who I believe are wrong, either on the facts or on the philosophy, my guiding principle is to first look in their eyes and see their humanity. To try to actually, you know, get a sense, a feeling for the other person as every bit as human as I am, and every bit as concerned about positive outcomes for life, for the planet, for their children, for the future, as I am. To tell myself the story that this person cares about our country just like I do. And then start from that as a starting point. Now, you know, of course there are a few people, and you'll probably hear more of them on the radio than you'll ever encounter in life, who are just paid shills. And they're just going to say what they say because their paycheck depends upon it. But generally speaking, when we encounter people in our lives who strongly hold opinions with which we disagree, there's a reason for it. And I think, you know, drilling into that reason and asking people is a useful way to go about it. Just two quick notes here. Walmart. This is bizarre. This is the, where is this from? I don't have, it's from Raw Story. Repost over Democratic Underground. Walmart is moving forward with felony charges against an employee of an Indiana store who admitted to eating multiple Oreo cookies because, she said, she couldn't afford to pay for them with her salary. Portage Police Department report obtained by The Smoking Gun on Thursday said that Petty Winters had been arrested after a Walmart investigation determined she was guilty of theft. Company reviewed surveillance video after an open bag of Oreo cookies was found in the store. Yep, her son explained to WBBM that his mother could not afford to pay for the items because she only made $11.40 an hour after working for Walmart for 8 years. She could be sentenced to jail. If found guilty, she's charged with felony theft. This is starting to look like, you know, the 1840s. In Ireland, where the Irish could not grow their own food on their own land. They could grow potatoes a little bit, sort of, but mostly they had to grow wheat, and that wheat was for export to England, and you could go to jail for eating it. And the British, made it into bread, and some of it went to the French, and of course, you know, actually, Marie Antoinette was long dead by then. But nonetheless, then the potatoes got that blight. You know, they got the fungus, the potato blight, and you had the potato famine, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, but in any case, it seems like America increasingly is starting to look like, you know, early 19th century Ireland, or at least the Walmart part of America. And Louis Gohmert, that fount of wisdom from the great state of Texas, representing that state in the United States House of Representatives, Louis Gohmert says that we need our guns, we need the Second Amendment. The founders knew this was coming, you see, to protect us from Sharia law. Yep, the Second Amendment is for our protection, and the founders' quotes make it very clear, and including against a government that would run amok. We got some people who think Sharia law should be the law of the land, forget the Constitution, but the guns are there to make sure all the rest of the amendments are followed. Right, Louis? Okay, how would I debate this with Louis Gohmert? I'll tell you about that in a little bit. But first, let's get some of your thoughts. Hack in Oklahoma City. Hey, Hack, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up?
Yeah, hey, I was in a discussion of gun control with some conservative friends of mine, and I was able to use one of your arguments, Tom.
Which was that?
Well, I guess it wasn't really an argument, but the conversation escalated, and I said that whenever Wayne LaPierre testifies, they should run pictures of the Newton massacre down at the bottom of the screen. Remember when you said that a couple weeks ago?
Yeah.
And then the people I was talking to just went crazy.
Yeah.
So after that, I can't be as angry. And I want it just to be a little bit calmer.
Okay. So your strategy is to poke the bear. Okay. Heck, thanks a lot for the call, for sharing that with us. John in Morgantown, Indiana. John, how do you deal with conservatives?
I'm fine. How are you, Tom?
Great. Great.
Great and getting better, I hope.
Indeed.
I'm a long-time listener.
Well, thank you.
I, in fact, write poetry and political in nature, and I have many people I converse with, and where I live is a lot of right-wingers. So I keep in my pickup truck the definition of liberal, several copies of it from the American Heritage College Dictionary. And in those discussions, when they occur, I just give them a copy of it. And some read it, but the most radical refuse to read it and in some cases refuse to take it. So I think that's telling.
Yeah, yeah. In other words, please don't confuse me with facts.
Yeah. And basically all it says is that we are free from bigotry and resist authoritarianism. But
well, and I think the essence of liberalism is open to new ideas and to exploring new paths. And there's actually something very non-pejorative about liberal or conservative definitions when you put it in that frame. Because, you know, William F. Buckley, who was a conservative who I had and have, even though he's passed away, tremendous respect for.
I watched his television show.
Yeah, I used to watch Firing Line with my dad. And I interviewed him for one of my books. I mean, there's, you know, anyhow, William F. Buckley said that a conservative is a man who stands athwart astride the arc of history with his hand out shouting, stop. And, you know, conservatives are people who are slow to change and slow to accept ideas, careful, cautious about accepting new ideas. Liberals are folks, generally speaking, who are more willing to embrace new ideas, try new things. And that's a classic. I mean, that's a definition that's three centuries old. And that's the definition that George Washington had in mind when he talked about America being a liberal country. We were trying this radical experiment of not having a king. And, you know, that was called liberal back then. John, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And we're going to get into some economics in our second hour. In our third hour, the Supreme Court. Are they going to take away our vote? Welcome back. One of our callers today, and it could be in our first hour, our second hour, our third hour. Who knows when the caprice is going to strike, Mr. Shano. One caller today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back. That free signed copy of Unequal Protection will be sent, by the way, using stamps.com. That caller could be you. So give us a shout. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
You want to know the reason? Excuse me. The way I talk to people of opposite views is, first of all, I refuse to fight. I always remember Newton's third law of motion: every action creates an equal opposite reaction. Mm-hmm. So you move away from me, you become a vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum. Thus, you ask questions. First of all, you need to learn about them. You need, because you don't have a right to criticize if you don't know where they're coming from.
Right.
So ask them questions and become a friend of theirs by asking them. You know, learning really about what they're about. And then use a gentle version of Socratic method to, you know, keep going back and see if they have any basis to stand on. Usually by them just answering questions, they will destroy themselves. They'll hang themselves.
Very interesting.
They can't answer them.
Very interesting.
Another thing, Search for Common Ground.
Yeah.
Commonground.org. Their methodology is just fantastic on how to deal with people of opposite views. I recommend people go to their website. I think it's sfcg.org, I believe.
Okay. And these are, by the way, strategies that, you know, conservatives should advise conservatives to use as well. I mean, this is
it's
just
amazing how it works. One time I unfortunately allowed myself to get in the fight. You know, I had a girlfriend who she loved to play fight. I started arguing with her. I said, what the hell am I doing it? And I asked her two questions, and in 15 seconds, she goes, you just destroyed my argument.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
You don't have to make statements. You just ask questions.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it works. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Good one. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Just wanted to talk about the Dunning-Kruger effect, but got to comment one thing. You're exactly right when you said, you know, it all began with Reagan, and I'll tell you, it's been 32 years of bad luck. But
yeah, it really has. I mean, for our country, you know, Reaganomics, trickle-down economics, and all it produced was a nation of peons.
It sure has. Well, you know, this Dunning-Kruger effect, you know.
What is the Kruger
sure
effect?
Probably heard of it.
Are you talking about cognitive bias?
Yes, yes. I stumbled upon this the other day on the Internet. You know, it talks about where unskilled people, they make poor decisions, you know, and they reach erroneous conclusions, you know. But their incompetence, it denies them the metacognitive ability to recognize their mistakes. You know, so basically they rate their ability above average, way higher than it actually is.
Well, that's typical of all
people. The average skilled person, what's that, Tom?
Isn't that typical of all people? Or actually there was a really interesting study done about 4 years ago that showed that optimists tended to rate themselves more highly than others, and pessimists tend to rate themselves more poorly than others, in a whole spectrum of things, from, you know, likability to competence at work.
Right. Well, you know, I'm thinking some of this might be some of the reasons why the people in the poor red states down south, Mississippi, Alabama, and that, you know, they're voting Republican. You know, they're stupid and they don't know it, to paraphrase things.
Well, or uneducated, you know, lacking access to education. Because you take those same people and put them in more affluent environments, and, I mean, this is not a matter of genetics. You put them in more affluent environments, or you raise them in more affluent environments, in more liberal environments, blue states, and they turn into smarter people, and they end up going to college and things like that. So, and this is one of the reasons why I think it was so important. I think this is one of the things that drove Lyndon Johnson and Bobby Kennedy. I mean, really big. Lyndon Johnson picked up the torch from Bobby Kennedy of trying to break the cycle of poverty. Because if you can break that cycle of poverty, if you can throw people, if you can help lift people up from, or give them the bootstraps to pull themselves up from the lower economic classes into the middle class, then that becomes the staging ground for an incredible variety of futures that are completely unavailable to them when they lack education and they lack resources and they're struggling literally to put food on the table. So, Steve, excellent point. Terry in Pahrump, Nevada. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Over the hump in Pahrump, just west of Las Vegas.
There you go.
You know, I really appreciate Jeff's approach. I unfortunately have never had the personality to be able to pull that off. I'm what they call a storm the beach kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I went through many years of heated debates that got ugly. So what I choose to do now is I rely on a little bit of shaming people and a little bit of technology. I am a high school dropout, never went to college, totally self-educated. I bring to people's attention that they're probably better educated than I am, and then I listen to their arguments, and I have saved everything to debunk their arguments on my telephone. And I kind of shame them into reading it in public because they don't want to be perceived as not being open-minded in a public place.
You mean like you keep like web pages or notes or things on a smartphone?
Absolutely. I have the Constitution. I have the Declaration of Independence. I keep everything.
Oh, I have an app for that. Yeah, I've actually pulled the Constitution out on my phone a number of times and quoted from it to people. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I use the technology, and I play in pool leagues, so I do it in public. When we're in a public place, I say, I truly understand your argument because I came from a ridiculously conservative background. I voted for Ed Clark in 1980. So, then when Reagan came in, I started noticing things and learned the truth.
Yeah.
And I point out that I truly understand their argument, and I know you're better educated than I am, but this is what I have found out. Would you mind taking a look at it?
That's brilliant. I was having, Louise and I were having dinner with a friend of ours from Los Angeles here in D.C. He was out visiting, who is an attorney, and we were in a restaurant, and he starts going off on how, you know, the Supreme Court is going to do this or that. And I said, yeah, I don't think they should, you know, be striking down laws. I don't think they have the power to do that. And he's like, well, of course they have the power to do that. They've been doing it forever. You know, I went to law school. I learned about it. It's called judicial review. And I said, really? And he's like, yeah. And he expounded about it for a minute or so. And as he's doing that, I'm opening the Constitution on my phone and I handed it to him. And I said, okay, here's Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. Read that paragraph and tell me where it says that the Supreme Court has the power to overturn laws passed by Congress. It looks to me like it says the exact opposite, that Congress has the power to regulate the Supreme Court. And he said, oh, that would be silly. And then he reads it, and there's just this long moment of silence. And he's like, I got to talk to somebody who knows constitutional law. It's like, here I am.
Yep, technology, you know, it's worked for me.
Yeah, I'm with you. Terry, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Tracy in Amherst, Mass. Hey, Tracy, thanks for listening to WHMP. Hi. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great.
So I kind of disagree, but it's basically a question I have for you. So my family has pretty much ostracized me completely over politics.
Oh, no.
They're extremely conservative and rigidly authoritarian and, you know, anti-gay, anti-feminist, anti, you know, overtly racist, all of it. Hmm. And so my question is, how do you reach people that are that rigid and that authoritarian in their conservatism, they're that absolute, that they won't acknowledge your humanity because to do so would violate their own political principles? So it's like, how do you acknowledge their humanity when they can't acknowledge yours to the point where they'll get rid of family members?
Yeah. I think if there's any basis for still maintaining a family tie with them, that the thing to do is just nice them to death. I mean, you know, to absolutely be as human as you can. If, you know, I do know of situations. I mean, I saw this when I was growing up. I've told the story before. My apologies if I'm repeating it. But when I was, well, by that time I was probably 20, but and out of not living in, at home any longer. But the family next door had a daughter. It was a son and daughter. The son was about my age. The daughter was about 5 years younger, and or not 5 years younger. She was 2 or 3 years younger. And when she was, she wanted to get married, and she wanted to marry a black man. The family next door was white. In fact, she was blonde. And her parents absolutely said, no way, we will not go to the wedding. We will not have anything to do with it. This is not tolerable. Now, this was in you know, the late 60s. And so she came, she and her brother knew my parents, and they knew my family. And she came over and one night asked, very tearfully, asked my dad if he would walk her down the aisle, if he would give her away at her wedding. And he said yes. And that was the end of my parents' relationship, my family's relationship with our next door neighbors, who several years later moved away. And it was, to the best of my knowledge, for the next couple of years that we kept in touch, the end of her relationship with her family. So in some circumstances, there's just nothing that can be done. But in others, I think that if you can, you know, characterize your essential humanity by being there for them when they need you and finding out what their life crises are and struggles and being empathetic, that, you know, maybe you'll end up being that crazy liberal aunt or sister or, you know, whatever. But eventually, oh yeah, I think this is what's happened with the gradual acceptance, and the more rapid acceptance since it's been increasingly okay to come out of gays in our society, is that people are discovering in every family that they've got a few, you know? Right. Holy cow, I never realized, you know, cousin so-and-so is gay. And now I know. And, you know, I've known cousin so-and-so for years and years. He's not such a bad guy, or she's not so very, very odd. And so I guess maybe, you know, and so that's...
You're kind of describing, you know, something we're talking about with the sequester, too, which is that there's a difference between an Eisenhower Republican and a Tea Party Republican in terms of where they, whether or not they draw lines in the sand and whether or not they're willing, they take a nihilist position of, you know, I'm just going to blow the whole thing up if you don't see it my way.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I mean, I want to be humane, too, but... But when you come from that family, it's hard to do that.
I absolutely understand. And you know, fortunately, thank God, I didn't come from a family like that. I mean, my father and I used to fight politics like cats and dogs. And he once actually kicked me out of the house over a political debate about the Vietnam War. But you know, by and large, he was a very good guy, even for a Republican. Tracy, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Debating Conservatives 101, Crash Course, first hour of our program. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you and Elaine in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on 1350 AM. Hey, Elaine.
Hey, Tom. Just during the break, you were talking to the guy about the Walmart story. I think it was Business Insider talking about emails between Walmart executives, how they're freaking out that they have no income coming in for February. And I think that they're thinking it has to do with the payroll tax cut going back. And so they have no money in their pockets and they're worried about, you know,
right. Cause the, you know, people who are making minimum wage just saw their taxes go up 2%.
Right, right. But the reason I called was about, I've been fascinated by this topic of talking to conservatives for years, and I often get really hopeless. Like, I love Jeff's idea, but again, I don't have the personality to deal with that generally because I'm way too passionate and get too argumentative. But I want to tell you about one experience I had that gives me a lot of hope, and it was, I was in a restaurant with my girlfriend at breakfast here in Albuquerque, like at the end of the 90s, and up ahead in line, we're waiting in line, there's a table that's full of lesbians. I just look over at my girlfriend and we smile. And then as we're getting closer to the table, the couple behind us see them, and the man, I don't even know who they are, I just hear this man start talking about how off they are, you can't go anywhere without seeing them, because they had seen this table full of lesbians. And I think maybe the lesbians had had children with them, and which I think maybe set the guy off, you know, a lot more because there were kids involved. And so the guy is like, I just can't believe, he's just cursing to whoever is with him. And I haven't turned around, and he's, you can't go anywhere without seeing them, and da-da-da-da. And then I finally got to the point where I just turned around. I said, well, just get used to it, because you're behind two right now. And he exploded. And I literally thought that we were going to come to blows. And I was like looking at where the utensils were on the next table, you know, in case I had to, you know,
defend yourself. Yeah.
Right. And then he just went off and he started talking about, and I turned back around and I had my back to him, which was really scary, but I just, then he started escalating and talking about how AIDS was invented to kill off you people, and just went on and on and on. And I was like, whoa, this is going to, like, where's the security guard? This is going to get really violent. And I have a really bad temper. And I was basically, if he touched me, I was going to take him out. And I've had fights with guys before. So it gets more and more escalating. And then we advance in line. My girlfriend goes off to get her food. I'm there by myself with him. And so really on edge. And then suddenly I hear him say, I'm sorry, ma'am. And I just spun around. I thought he was, like, really yanking my chain. I spun around, like you mentioned earlier, and I looked at his eyes to see if he was messing with me. And he wasn't messing with me, Tom. And he put his eyes down, and he says, I'm really sorry, ma'am. I didn't mean to offend you.
It was his come-to-Jesus moment.
Come to Jesus, and I just looked at him and I said, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
And he just nodded, and it was like a religious experience.
Yeah.
And I think just after he blew off all his steam and got through all his hatred, he just realized it was another human being right in front of him.
Yeah.
So whenever I get really discouraged, I think about that moment. It gives me so much hope that even these hateful, hateful people.
Yeah, and it's not just a testimonial to the power of confronting bigotry. It's a testimonial to the power of being out. I mean,
right.
there's a lot of power in that. That's wonderful. Elaine, thank you for sharing the story with us. And
you're welcome. Thanks.
Thanks so much for calling in. Paul in Minneapolis. Hey, Paul, thanks for listening to AM 950. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to say I've been listening to you for a while now. You mentioned your principle of how you debate conservatives, and I've been wanting to kind of say this to you for a while, is that the one thing I really like about your show is that not only do you, you know, have the courage to take on, you know, these people and you know, kind of relish in it even, but more importantly, you respect their opinions, which you don't see a lot on the other side.
Yeah.
But anyway,
unfortunately, and we don't, and frankly, on our side, it's lacking very often in the discourse, which I think is unfortunate.
Yeah, I agree. Now, as far as talking to conservatives, I myself, I'm rather introverted by nature, so, you know, being right in front of you know, a person in debating or whatnot doesn't really work out for me that well. I always come up with things to say afterwards. So what really works for me is like Facebook. You know, I can put something on there, and you know, my conservative friends will respond to it, and I can sit and I can think about it and just kind of do my best to reason with them.
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't always work.
That's great. Well, but you've found a medium, a vehicle in which you can have those debates. And that's great. Paul, thank you for sharing that with us. And thanks for listening. Anthony in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Anthony.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great. I think we got about a minute to the end of this hour, though. So, quick one.
Well, heck, I don't got a quick one. I'll try to make it quick.
Okay.
I'm a soldier. I work on post. I wish I was dealing with Republicans. That'd be easy. I'm dealing with Tea Partiers, and they are so much less reasonable than Republicans.
Mm.
But I deal with conspiracy theories. I spend so much of my time dedicated to debunking ridiculous conspiracy theories, like the government planned Sandy Hook sort of situations.
Whoa.
It is, most people have not been submitted to the ridiculousness that I got to hear from these people on a daily basis. And I spend most of my time researching this, coming to work the next day and saying, hey, this is the information that I have. These are the reasons what you have makes no sense, and you should really reevaluate your way of thinking.
These are other soldiers?
These are other soldiers.
Wow. That's
to be fair, these are other soldiers, but these are also the same. They're just Americans. But,
yeah. Yeah. I got it. It's remarkable. And I'm sure the truck drivers would tell you the same story. I mean, I've been in enough truck stops and seen Fox News and overheard enough conversations. Anthony, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for sharing it with us. The debunker of the conspiracy crazy. That's a good one. We'll be right back. One of our callers today going to get a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the president in his... Welcome back to the program, by the way, to our second hour. The president in his State of the Union address... Well, actually, it was... it was State of the Union. In his State of the Union address, called for an increase in the national minimum wage, which would be about $10.25 to $10.50 an hour if it was where it was in 1968 and adjusted for inflation over the years. And instead, is at $7.25, he said raise it, as I recall, to $9. There you go. That's a pretty substantial raise. But it's still below where it was in 1968. It seems like we were doing just fine in 1968. Numerous states have raised their minimum wage, not only without negative consequences, but with explicitly, overtly positive consequences. When I lived in Portland, Oregon, they raised the minimum wage on wait staff from $2 an hour to the state minimum wage, which is over $8 an hour. And everybody was saying, oh, it's going to be a disaster. The sky's going to fall. Actually, no, things went just fine. Harry Versier is with us. Am I saying that right, Harry?
Verizer.
My apologies. Harry Professor Harry Verizer, professor of economics, University of Detroit Mercy, the author of It Didn't Have to Be This Way, Why Boom and Bust is Unnecessary, and How the Austrian School of Economics Breaks the Cycle. udmercy.edu is the website. I don't get it. How can you argue, as the Austrian school typically does, that the free market is going to solve all our problems when there's no such thing as a free market?
Well, I don't think they do. I mean, We all realize that there's a certain limitation in human affairs. The free market is really a practical decision. And remember, there isn't really such thing as a free market or a free enterprise system. It's what happens when certain things are done. It's a byproduct.
Right. It's just like there's no such thing as a free football game. You have referees, you have rules, you have goalposts, everybody agrees on the rules. And so that being the case, what's wrong with everybody agreeing that if we as a society are going to give business people certain privileges and immunities from financial liability, the ability to deduct lunch and travel, the ability to make a profit, and even if you make a profit in a particular way, pay a lower income tax on it than average working people do. If we're going to give them all these in exchange for this, at the very least, we're going to say, pay a decent wage.
Sure.
What's wrong with that?
Here's the thing. Rhetorically, it sounds very good. And remember, as an economist, my job is not to say what you should do. It's what to say what the consequences are, under what conditions you make the decision. So if you make a decision, that's up to you what you want to do. But you should know that everything does involve a cost. And the question is that we are to say, okay, these are the costs involved.
Right. And my question is, what are the costs to society of having a lot of people living in poverty because employers are paying such low wages?
Well, now, that's a very good question because of the fact that, remember, in economics you have something called the principle of regressivity. And what that really says is that people at the lower income levels are affected much more by economic moves and regulations and taxes than people at the upper level. For example, let's say Bill Gates, let's say gasoline went to $10 a gallon, just hypothetically. Well, it's not going to affect the wealthy, like Bill Gates, as much as it's going to affect the person who's, you know, who's working for minimum wage.
But on the other hand, if the capital gains tax went from 20% to 39%, if we did what Ronald Reagan did in 1986 and made them the same and what Reagan called for, that would affect Bill Gates in a big way, and the average working person wouldn't notice it at all. So, you know, it's a matter of picking and choosing what regulations
are
changes.
No, wait, you didn't let me finish.
Okay, go for it.
Let's say gasoline fell to 50 cents a gallon. Well, who's going to benefit more? Well, obviously the poor person is going to benefit more. So what regressivity says is as you do these things in the economy and they show themselves in price levels or they show themselves in cost, this is going to have the effect. Now, taxes are different. That's a little bit different.
Well, hang on just a second. Let's just finish this first one. I would argue that if gasoline fell to 50 cents, the people who would benefit the most would be the very wealthy people who are engaged in business, because now the real job creators in our society, the people who spend 100% of their income, are going to have more income to spend, and that's going to create more demand in the economy. It's going to stimulate the economy. There's more demand for goods and services, and so the people who are making the most off the sale and distribution and manufacture goods and services are going to make even more.
Well, here's the situation.
But the Walmart heirs are going to get richer.
Okay. Wait. Here's the situation now. If gasoline, let's say gasoline were to fall to 50 cents a gallon, all right? The poor people, probably gasoline is a much greater percent of their income than it is of the wealthy.
But they have a limited need for it.
Well, yeah, well, we all have a limited need, but some people's need is much greater part of their income than others is.
Right.
And that's where the principle of regressivity comes in.
But there is a limit to the principle of regressivity. In other words, if somebody's driving 10 miles to work every day, they're still driving 10 miles to work every day. Now they've got a little extra in their pocket. But
yes.
But let's bring this back to the minimum wage here. We're talking with Professor Harry Verizer.
You mentioned Oregon.
Sure. Okay? I lived there for five years.
Explain. I was out in Oregon, and I talked to a fellow in Jacksonville, Oregon, who runs a business called the Jacksonvillian.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about the minimum wage. And
right.
He said, look, he said, I used to hire quite a few teenagers that would come in here in the summer, and they would go on to get degrees in culinary arts or hospitality management. And he was quite proud of the fact. I mean, he said, I had a number of graduates who've come here. They've done very well and whatever else. This was their beginning job. He said, now, look, he said, my business is very tight. He says, when they raise the minimum wage, I'm no longer able to do that. So what's happening is a lot of businesses, just like the Jacksonville Inn, and I'd invite you to call him. He'd be glad to tell you his story.
Well, I'm surprised that he had that problem, because this was not a statewide issue. This was just the city of Portland, which is not Jacksonville. So he wasn't confronted with a problem.
He was.
How so?
Well, he told me that. He said, look, he says...
Well, maybe what had happened was that the competing businesses, you know, other companies had decided to adopt Portland's minimum wage for waiters and waitresses, and so, you know, it was spreading, just like the way, you know, whenever there's if you've got 12% of the population has union jobs, another 12% will have the equivalent of union jobs, because they tend to set the local floor for wages. But that whole phenomena of, gee, minimum wage jobs used to be entry-level jobs for teenagers, I'm with you on that. I mean, you know, I flipped hamburgers when I was 14 years old, and I had to get a work permit to do it because I was under 16. And or maybe it was under 17 in Michigan. Every state had different rules. And we would flip burgers at Henry's Hamburgers. And that was an entry-level job back then. And everybody who worked in Henry's Hamburgers when I was working there was under 20 years old. Now you walk in there, you'll find people in their 30s, their 40s. Well, Henry's is out of business. But you walk into McDonald's, you find, you know, people who would normally be in a mainstream economy. And I would say that that's not caused by the minimum wage. That's caused by this enormous shift in wealth out of the middle class and into the top 1%.
Yeah. Now, Tom, if you take a look at the statistics, when did that start happening?
With Reagan.
No. 1971, when Nixon broke the gold standard. And ever since then, we've had inflation. What you're looking at is the results of inflation. Inflation creates...
Are you trying to tell me we did not have inflation before 71?
If you take a look at the statistics, under the Bretton Woods Agreement from 1946 to 1971, and you can go on BLS.com.
No, no, the price of gold was fixed, and so and you had 41 currencies around the world that were pegged to the U.S. dollar. I understand
right.
that, and that got
okay.
blown up in 1941 or 1971. But
yes.
but between Bretton Woods and 71, there was inflation.
The prices doubled. The next 25 years, from 71 to 96, prices went up four times.
Well, in large part because the cost of oil went up so much because our society was dependent on oil. You know, there's a strong body of economic evidence that argues that inflation, outside of the inflation caused by, you know, the Fed, you know, regulated inflation, is actually the consequence of core commodities going up.
Sure, but what moves core commodities up is the drop in the value of the dollar. The dollar was falling.
But the price of oil went up for in euros. It went up in lira, in guilders.
But oil is priced in dollars. Worldwide, oil isn't priced in dollars, Tom.
But they all had... okay, all right. All right. Harry Versayer, Verizon. I'm sorry, Verizon.
Yeah.
Professor of Economics, University of Detroit Mercy. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, what should we do about the minimum wage? I think we should raise it. I think it should be, you know, if you can't make a living, then you shouldn't be working. Or vice versa. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, I don't think I'm prescient, and I don't think I'm driving events. I think I'm just a fairly good observer. But, you know, since the Newtown massacre, in fact, I think it was probably the day after, or in the day, immediately in the days after, I had been, up until that point, I'd had a fairly laissez-faire attitude about guns. My opinion on guns had been local communities or states should simply come up with the rules that they think work best for them. And in retrospect, there was a certain naivete associated with that because those local communities and states are being corrupted by the gun industry. You got Wayne LaPierre with his $1 million-a-year salary out there as a paid shill. You got the NRA, which makes, you know, a little bit of money every time a gun is sold by some manufacturers. You've got, you know, all these influencers. And so anyhow, after Newtown, I started saying, well, why don't we just treat guns the way we treat cars? Register them from the time they're made until the time they're destroyed. They have a serial number, just like a car has a VIN number. Demonstrate proficiency. And this actually would be a big boon for the NRA. They could get into the business. Actually, they already are in the business of training people in how to safely use firearms and how to own them and store them and things like that. And require insurance, liability insurance, just like with a car. Got to have liability insurance. In fact, you heard me say many times on this program, why is it that if those 20 kids in Newtown, Connecticut had been mowed down by a drunk driver, that right now their families would all be sitting on, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars because that driver, and which would have been paid out by Allstate or Geico or whoever, you know, by the auto insurance company, because drivers in Connecticut are required to carry mandatory liability insurance for things like killing people. Whereas because they were killed with a gun, they didn't even get, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 to bury their kids. They got nothing. So gun owners should also carry liability insurance. Very above the fold, top story in the New York Times online right now. I don't any longer subscribe to the print edition. But just because of living in a marina, you can't get newspapers delivered to you. And so Louise and I read everything online now. Because I used to love to just read the New York Times and the Financial Times in the morning. But, yeah, life in the big city. But so I don't know where this is in the print edition, but I can tell you it's at the top of the online edition. Latest front in the gun debate is mandatory insurance, is the headline. And the opening paragraph, in a society sharply, this is by Michael Cooper and Mary Williams Walsh, in a society sharply divided over efforts to curb violence and the right to bear arms, both sides of the gun debate seem to agree on at least one thing, a bigger role for the insurance industry to play in a heavily armed society. Really? See, I think this is just like really cool. So anyhow, there's that. I just wanted to share that with you. Secondly, I didn't have an opportunity to really get into the facts and figures in what was going to be a debate with Professor Verizer. Some interesting stats over at mattcowgill.wordpress.com, looking at the real minimum wage in the United States, and then looking at a whole bunch of different countries: Turkey, France, New Zealand, Slovenia, Latvia, Portugal, Australia, Greece, Belgium, Hungary, Lithuania, Romania, Iceland, Netherlands, United Kingdom, Slovak Republic, Canada, Portugal, Spain, Luxembourg, Korea, Estonia, Japan, United States, and the Czech Republic. Wow. I've been to every one of these countries except one. In any case, that in all of these countries, in some of them, people make more and some people make less. Some have minimum wage, some don't. There doesn't seem to be any relationship between a minimum wage and, excuse me, there doesn't seem to be any relationship between a minimum wage and levels of unemployment. And, in fact, that was one of the questions I was going to ask the professor was, please identify for me any year in the history of the United States since the minimum wage was put into place in 1936, any one year, or two or three. Actually, you'd have to look at a two- or three-year period to see how the effects of a minimum wage work through the economy, where a minimum wage actually caused inflation or caused unemployment or caused the nature of the labor force to change, drove teenagers out of the marketplace, you know, all the things that the anti-minimum wage people say. And when I started to bring that stuff up, he instead said, oh, it's because we went off the gold standard, inflation, and which is a whole nother discussion that, you know, we can have, but I really wanted to talk about the minimum wage. I just strongly believe that our minimum wage should be $9 an hour. I mean, you know, frankly, I think our minimum wage should be $10.25 an hour because I was alive in 1968 and I remember, you know, the job market. I was in the job market in 1968 and working for the minimum wage. I was a dishwasher at Bob's Big Boy on Trowbridge Road in East Lansing and a chef. And for one day I was a waiter. I worked at the gas station across the street, the Esso station, I think it was at that time. And, you know, I pumped gas and I changed tires. I worked in a radio station on the weekends. My first gig in radio was on the weekends in 68, WITL, spinning records, doing country music, country western music. And virtually all those jobs are minimum wage jobs, and I could live on that. And I could live on that and go to college. And you can't do that now. So, well, and college, of course, was a whole lot cheaper then because back in 1968, 80% roughly of the cost of college was paid for by state, federal, and local governments, mostly state and federal. And only 20% of the cost of college was tuition, whereas today about 80% of the cost of college is tuition and about 20% is paid for by governments. And so it's flipped upside down. So maybe we should even make the minimum wage higher if you want the minimum wage to be what is necessary so that young people can go to college and they can take a minimum wage job. They can put themselves through college, you know, as a waiter or as a, you know, dishwasher or pumping gas or what. In the one state, I guess, left, Oregon, where they actually are required to pump gas as opposed to self-serve. That was culture shock. When we moved to Oregon, and I jumped out to pump my own gas, and the guy comes running out of the gas station with his hands in the air going, no, you can't do that. I go to jail. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The rationale for that law, by the way, in Oregon was that, you know, people catch themselves on fire pumping their own gas, but the effect was that people could, you know, have more jobs. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, well, here's the... A couple of people have called about this, and so Shane and Danielle went off on a search and tracked it down. It seems to have started with Bloomberg, although Business Insider picked it up. Bloomberg's Renee Dudley reporting, this is a leaked email. Jerry Murray, Walmart's Vice President of Finance and Logistics, in a February 12th email to other executives. In case you haven't seen a report these days, the worst start to a month I've seen in my 7 years with the company. They're talking about February. This month, have you ever had one of those weeks where your best prepared plans weren't good enough to accomplish everything you set out? Geiger asked in a February 1 email to executives. Well, we just had one of those weeks here at Walmart US. Where are all the customers and where's their money? In the Bloomberg report, they interviewed the CEO of Family Dollar. You know, one of these everything's a dollar stores, I'm guessing. Another store that caters to basically the bottom quintile, the bottom fifth of Americans. Higher payroll taxes go against our customers' wallet, Howard Levine, the CEO of Family Dollar, said in a conference call on January 3rd. Clearly, they do not have as much for discretionary purchases as they did. Walmart's Geiger urged employees to improve business by fixing something that could really make a difference on our performance. We need to stop the stupid, he said. Amazing. And they note, Bloomberg notes that when the payroll tax break expired December 31st, the end of December. Now, this was what happened was a year ago or 2 years ago, one of the deals that the president made with the Republicans to stimulate the economy was that they would cut the payroll tax, the Social Security tax, the payroll tax, which is only paid on the first $113,000 of income every year. It's only paid by people who make $113,000 a year or less. If you make, $1 million a year, you only pay 1/10 of your income on this. If you make $1 billion a year, you pay 1/100 of your income. Actually, you don't even pay that. You're only 1/100 of your income is subject to that FICA tax, that Social Security tax. And and from the Democrats' point of view, it was a good thing because it stimulated the economy, and they needed the economy to pick up a little bit before the election. The election, of course, is over now. And from the Republican, and I'm giving you the most cynical analysis here, but I think it's accurate. And from the Republicans' point of view, it was a good thing because it reduced revenue going into the Social Security Trust Fund. So it would speed up the actuarial date at which the Social Security program would start paying less than 100% of benefits. You know, kick it up from 2029 to 2027 or something like that. So they could get all hysterical and something else that they could, you know, run around with their hair on fire about. You know, about how we need to privatize Social Security, hand it off to Hank or to John Paulson, the Wall Street billionaire, whose company, by the way, has just been outed for having a reinsurance program in, I believe, the Bahamas, where they're cycling hundreds of millions of dollars, billionaire dollars, through so that those people can avoid paying taxes. But in any case, we let that expire, and you know, Bernie has been on this program about this, Bernie Sanders. It was not a good way to stimulate the economy because it did take money out of Social Security, trust fund or out of Social Security, which is not a healthy thing. On the other hand, it did stimulate the economy because the real job creators are the people at the bottom. And if you want proof of that, just look at this, you know, and here's they did the math. It's $19.7 billion more in tax refunds have been delivered to shoppers by this time last year. In other words, we saw about almost a $20 billion cut in tax refunds. I guess that doesn't have so much to do with the payroll tax as this. But then they say when the payroll tax break expired at the end of the year, for a person making $40,000 a year, that's about $15 a week. The extra tax bite is equal to a year of car insurance for a family making $30,000 a year, or a basket of groceries every month for a family making $50,000 a year, according to Walmart's analysis. So, you know, my response to this is, okay, instead of going back to cutting the tax on Social Security, why don't we raise the minimum wage? You have the same effect. You're putting more money in the hands of people at the bottom of the economic food chain. They're going to spend that money. It's going to stimulate the economy. Walmart and dollar stores are going to do better. And thus, the entire, you know, ultimately the entire economy will do better. So we'll see where this goes. Sam in Chicago. Hey, Sam, you wanted to talk about changing conservative minds?
Yes, Tom. Hi. My own anecdote about it, about changing minds, is that it's possible and it can be tough, but it could take many years. So I'm a gay man. I'm about 30 years old, and I come from a very conservative family. Many pastors are in the family. My dad is a pastor at a fundamentalist evangelical church, and I grew up being instilled with, you know, guilt and shame, and I heard from the pulpit specifically that homosexuality is an abomination and a sin against God. And when I finally realized around 20 years old that I was gay, I honestly thought that I'd never be able to come out to my parents or my family, especially my parents. After a few years, I finally did. And my dad, that night, my dad basically preached at me into the hours of the morning, and my mom was just sitting there crying and bawling the whole time. And from that point until I met someone and decided that I wanted to spend my life with him was about 6 years. And between that time, I had probably dozens of conversations with my parents, just about my experience and being gay and being a gay person of faith. And slowly their minds began to change. And so when I wanted to have a commitment ceremony, with my partner, I kind of had always wanted my dad to officiate my marriage or ceremony. And so I asked him if he would, and he said, let me think about it. And, you know, I thought it was stupid. I never should have asked. It's never going to work out. But then 1 week later, it was in the evening, and I heard a knock on my door, and it was my dad, and he said, all right, Sam, I've never done this before. I've never officiated, you know, same-sex couple, but let's plan this thing out and let's do it. So I was thrilled. He did officiate, and I mean, my parents are both very supportive and affirming of me and my partner, and I really thought it would never happen. And I mean, change can happen, but it could take years.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a wonderful story, Sam. That's an absolutely wonderful story. And that's how we change people's minds, particularly people who are bigoted, whether they're bigoted because they believe that this is what God wants or because they're just, you know, whatever. And I get it. Your father was a decent man at the core. But we change their minds by being ourselves and by touching their essential humanity. By, you know, that's a marvelous story. Sam, thank you so much for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, you don't think raising the minimum wage is going to hurt the economy?
Right, right. Yeah, I wanted to respond to that so-called economist you had on who's...
Oh, hey, he's a professor of economics. I'm not, so...
Okay, all right. But, I'm just saying, but he's not looking at the macro, the big economic picture.
Well, I think he's wrong.
Right.
Yeah. Well, but he's not a so-called economist. He's a real economist.
When you raise the minimum wage, there will be fewer people will get laid off, and that's not true because they're ignoring the fact that when the minimum wages is raised, their own businesses will pick up and more than make up for the loss in money that they have to pay out in wages.
That's absolutely right. And this is what Walmart is experiencing right now. If the minimum wage was to go up, it would more than increase Walmart's business by the amount that they're losing because of the 2% pay cut that you know people making $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year just experienced because the FICA tax went back up. I think you're absolutely right, Paul. Spot on. Thanks a lot for the call and well said. Frank in Bensalem, Pennsylvania. Got a minute to the break, Frank. What you're opposed to raising the minimum wage?
I don't think it's going to do anything for the economy or for anybody. Is what I'm saying.
But it always has in the past. You go all the way back to 1936. Every time the minimum wage has raised, you've seen a significant increase in GDP, in economic activity. You've never seen a correlation with an increase in unemployment or inflation.
Go back to what you just said, okay, of the year.
Yeah, 1936 was the year it was put into place, yeah.
Okay, but go back, and where were products being made
here
back at that time? Right, where are they being made now?
Yeah.
So what you're going to do is you're going to increase the Waltons' bank account.
Yep.
You're not going to increase the productivity of America.
Yeah. Okay. On that point, Frank, I absolutely agree with you. We need to close that semi-permeable membrane around our borders called our trade policy and bring our jobs back home so that when those minimum wage workers spend that money, it doesn't just go through one or two hops in our economy before it vanishes into the depths of China. but instead it goes through, you know, dozens and dozens of hops. I'm with you, Frank. But I do think it still is a good thing. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
One caller today going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back. Welcome back to Talk Media for the Sane Among Us, the Tom Hartman Program. Somebody in the chat room yesterday. Oh, Ellen Ratner is going to be with us. Let's just go to Ellen, and I'll tell you this story about astrology in the chat room when we get back. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. Go to GoatsForTheOldGoat.com for more information on that. And speaking of goats for the old goat, the founder of the enterprise, Ellen Ratner, on the line with us at the Talk Radio News Service.
The old goat herself. I'm not doing anything by Skype today because I look like too much of an old goat. I'm okay. A little whatever. Okay. So 15 senators sent a letter to the White House that urged President Obama to withdraw his nomination of Chuck Hagel for defense secretary. His old friend, but now not so friendly, McCain, was not a part of that. Seems like McCain is back to his the self that some of us actually liked him in 2000 of. But it does look like Marco Rubio, Lindsey Graham, and some other folks, including the Armed Service Ranking Member James Inhofe in the Senate, John Cornyn, who is the minority whip, they all said that unless there is a majority for Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel ought not to be there, and his positions on Israel are not good. Well, when I looked at this list of names, I did not really see any Jews on here, even though that's what they're concerned about. And even Chuck Schumer, who really does work with the Jewish vote a lot, is not objecting to Chuck Hagel.
Yeah, I don't think this is about Israel, and Chuck Hagel's positions on Israel are not dissimilar from those of President Obama. This is a tempest in a tea. This is all about wounding Obama, in my opinion.
Everything's about wounding Obama. But the president looks like he's got the upper hand. A new poll has the president's approval rating reaching a three-year high. Some of the other issues on it were not so great. 55%. People are kind of worried about the economy, although the president still does better on that. They're a little uneasy with the nation's trajectory, a lot of people are saying. That's pretty much where things are at. So the president is using some of his political capital, and today he actually called up Speaker Boehner and the minority leader McConnell on the sequester issue. The White House would not release the text of the conversation, but basically said there was a conversation. The president, I think, has the upper hand, and although the Republicans are doing their very best to take it, I don't think they're going to be terribly successful on that front.
Okay. Now,
there's some other things. The White House, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the White House sort of going around the president on this golf outing. I mean, I think the golf outing issue is ridiculous, but I think it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back because so many of the press feel cut out. Well, today's sort of another example. I mean, I don't disagree with the content, and I don't disagree that the press sometimes does not put forth the content, but as you know and I know, sometimes they're not so good communicating with their own constituency and their own base to some degree, some of the more liberal talk show hosts. But today the White House did put out on their own blog about how the White House has balanced the budget. They said the president already reduced the deficit by over $2.5 trillion. Of course, that's over a 10-year period of time. And they said that he has laid out provisions on how to do more. But, of course, as we know, the Republican Congress is more interested in making a point than to go and actually support the president's budget. And the president, the White House, has said consistently the reason that they are so late with the budget is because they don't want a budget that's going to be dead on arrival. They want to do a budget that they think can pass and that people are going to agree with them on.
Right, which means they have to negotiate it with John Boehner, and every minute that he's negotiating, he's got Eric Cantor standing behind him with that little stiletto in his left kidney.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Good luck on that.
I love you, Tom. You are so funny sometimes. Okay, White House is trying to think about urging the court to overturn the gay marriage ban. This is that whole California issue.
Mm-hmm.
And this may be in a friend of the court briefing. As you already know, there are areas around the gay issue that the Justice Department is not going to carry out. So that's another one. And by the way, the White House is also doing quite a bit in terms of immigration. They are trying to get an agreement. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, believe it or not, and the AFL-CIO, and by the way, I think this has really been urged by the White House, and some congressional leaders have a breakthrough, they said, on some guidelines that they want people to follow in terms of the immigration issue. Tom Donahue and Richard Trumka revealed that they have actually some real principles on this. And they said, White House is saying they're encouraged by the news, but you know as well as I know that the White House is probably very much behind trying to get these groups together.
Yeah, in all probability.
Okay, some other news. The Supreme Court is basically saying, look, if we made a ruling, it cannot go back in terms of effect. This has to do, one, which they retroact. There was a decision that defense lawyers have to make clear to their clients when they cop a plea bargain, what the implications of this may be. Supreme Court says, well, if you know, now that we said that you have to do this, if it wasn't done before, we're not going to go back and vacate any sentences or that happened under this. But then they also said it would be unconstitutional if you did a retrial of this guy who was an accused arsonist, and they said that the judge, a federal judge, I believe, misinterpreted the law. How does a federal judge with all of that training misinterpret the law? Pretty staggering to me.
Well, I think the Supreme Court misinterprets the law constantly, and certainly they misinterpret their own authority.
But it sounds like the federal judge missed a big one on this one. Okay. There's a lot more interesting news, but Ed Markey, he is the representative from Massachusetts. A lot of people think that he may run for that Senate seat. John Kerry's seat, exactly. And this he said yesterday, but I don't think it sort of made it to some of the papers. Tell me if you already talked about this. He sort of compared the Citizens United case to the Dred Scott decision, speaking of the Supreme Court and when they make bad.
What a hoot. I have been using that metaphor virtually since the day the Citizens United was decided. I said, in Dred Scott, the Supreme Court ruled that people were property, and in Citizens United, it's the mirror image, the Supreme Court ruled that property, corporations, are people. And I'm so pleased to hear Ed Markey say that. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Have a great afternoon. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Occupying the Media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And Myrna Perez is with us. She is the senior counsel to the Brennan Center, brennancenter.org, the website. Senior counsel, head lawyer. Myrna, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for joining us. I'm curious your thoughts on this argument that's going before the Supreme Court that could conceivably blow up the Voting Rights Act, if I have this correct.
Mm-hmm.
Give us the details.
Sure. For generations, the Voting Rights Act has been instrumental in protecting the fundamental right to vote. It is one of our landmark civil rights laws. And on February 27th, Shelby County, Alabama, is challenging a very important and effective provision of the Voting Rights Act called Section 5, or sometimes it's called the preclearance provision. What that part of the Voting Rights Act does is it requires certain places that have a documented history of voting discrimination to submit any change they want to do to election procedures to either the Department of Justice or a federal district court before it goes into effect. And it will not go into effect unless it can be established that the change would not make minority voters worse off, or that it did not, it was not enacted to try and make minority voters worse off. This is an incredibly important part of the Voting Rights Act because it stops discrimination before it occurs.
Right. And typically this was enforced against basically southern, the old Confederate states.
Against those states that have had, again, a documented history of racial discrimination.
Right. But historically, that was there not a huge overlap between those states?
That's in fact the case.
Yeah. So I'm curious. I want you to give us your thoughts on how this is going to play out and who's behind it and what's going on. But also, it seems to me that Pennsylvania, for example, you know, if Wisconsin, Michigan, you've got states that were not part of the Confederacy that are not subject to oversight by the Voting Rights Act, because there hasn't been this history of discrimination, that are passing voter ID laws that are nakedly established to diminish the role of minorities in the electoral process. Shouldn't the Voting Rights Act be expanded? Shouldn't the DOJ be saying, hey, wait a minute, we're seeing more of this kind of discrimination?
Well, I think you are touching on incredibly important and interesting points, but there's a bit of a conflation that I'd like to clarify.
Please.
If I can. There is a provision of the Voting Rights Act called Section 2, which does apply nationwide. It allows the Department of Justice, it allows private individuals to go after laws that make it difficult for communities of color to elect their candidates of choice.
Is this why Pennsylvania has their voter ID law on hold?
No, that has to do with it being done under state law.
I see. Okay.
But the preclearance provision is a particular tool that is targeted and narrow to particular jurisdictions, because it is a very specific reaction to a very specific history. And if it was based on a lot of analysis and a lot of thought and a lot of research by Congress as to where this tool should be applied. Because it blocks laws before they're allowed to take effect, we want it to be carefully crafted. We want it to be able to apply only in circumstances where it is needed. And the way that Section 5 is devised now, it applies and it protects voters in those areas that are most likely to need that kind of protection.
Right. We're talking with Myrna Perez, the senior counsel at the Brennan Center. Is at BrennanCenter.org, of course, the website. Is it not pretty much the case that the argument that's being brought before the Supreme Court is, we don't have discrimination anymore. No droids in this car. We don't need this law anymore.
There's certainly a lot of elements that are present in the arguments that sound very much like what you suggested, the idea that discrimination is a thing of the past and that we've made progress and it's no longer timely. And I think that there's no dispute that we as a nation have made enormous progress in terms of racial equality, in terms of ending formal discrimination in our electoral processes. But it's not the case that discrimination doesn't happen. Just over the summer, a 3-judge federal court found that the state of Texas intentionally discriminated, not accidentally, intentionally discriminated against its minority voters when they were drawing district lines. And we have a number of examples in which we still see discriminatory elements. And consequently, we need something like Section 5, which will make sure that we stop the discriminatory practices before they're able to infect our electoral process.
Do you think that what are the early indications about how the court might rule on this?
The court has had this issue put before it many times. After the Voting Rights Act was voted bipartisan almost unanimously to continue in 2006, someone went in and challenged it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, every time the case has been before the Supreme Court, it's been upheld. The record was voluminous. Congress spent a lot of time listening to the evidence, looking at the record, hearing from experts, and the 15th Amendment of the Constitution gives Congress the power to try and end racial discrimination when voting. So I think that the court is going to do the right thing. I think the court is going to do the constitutional thing and is going to give Congress the deference that it is entitled under the 15th Amendment to try and root out racial discrimination in voting.
Wow. I you know, from your lips to God's ears, I hope you are right. I'm hearing, you know, that a lot of people are actually quite spooked by this, given, I mean, I'm not even a believer in judicial review. I think Marbury was wrongly decided. So, you know, well, you want to get into a rant about the court, but, that the partisanship, the naked partisanship on this court has gotten so extreme recently. I mean, they had a case this week that had to do with the Alien Torts Act where both sides were in agreement. There was no actual claim, and they appointed a third party to bring forward a front of the court brief to basically so that they could create law. I mean, it's bizarre what these guys are doing.
I mean, I think I certainly hear your concern, but I think the law in this is pretty easy. The 15th Amendment is very clear about what Congress's powers are, and this was not a decision that Congress undertook lightly. There were, you know, there was more than 20 hearings. There was 15,000 pages of documents, you know, unknown number of witnesses, and the decision was made, and it was done so very recently.
Yeah, we have just a couple of seconds left. What would be the constitutional argument to say, you know, instead of the we no longer have discrimination, what would be how could they blow it up on a constitutional basis?
How could the opposing side blow
the
it
court,
up on the constitutional
you know, if the court were to rule against the Voting Rights Act?
The way the ruling would work would be it would saying that it was an overextension of Congress's power. But again, I don't think that that's possible because the 15th Amendment ensures that the right to vote is not denied on account of race and gives Congress the authority to protect this right.
Yeah, that's pretty straightforward stuff. Very, very interesting. Myrna Perez, thanks so much for the enlightenment.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope you'll invite me back.
I would love to. Senior counsel with the Brennan Center, brennancenter.org. Myrna Perez, brilliant. Thank you so much. We will be right back. Keep an eye on the Supreme Court case, by the way. This is going to be a BFD. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Somebody is going to get a free copy of my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back, presumably in this hour. Taking back to mainstream media, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. Joe in Negaunee, Michigan? How do you say that, Joe?
Right.
Yeah.
Good job.
Whereabouts is that in Michigan? I grew up in Michigan.
Well, and I watch your show. I don't agree with a lot of things, but I watch your show. I think you grew up around Lansing. I'm up in the UP.
Up in the UP, okay. Therefore, that's why I lived up in the UP for one summer. I lived in a teepee up in the Cherokee National Forest up there, and I also worked when Louise when she was first pregnant with her first child. I was working for WNBY up in Newberry.
I'm right near Marquette. I'm about 3 miles from Lake Superior.
Yeah, it's where Louise's brother went to college, and he ships out of there now. He's a sea captain or
Great Lake.
On Lake Superior. Yeah. So anyhow, Joe, you wanted to talk about voter discrimination?
Well, I was just wondering, and again, I may not agree with you, but it doesn't make me angry.
That's nice.
You have to prove who you are when you go to the polls. Is that voter discrimination
That's a real reasonable question. And I don't think that it is voter discrimination if you have to prove who you are when you go to the polls. And typically, in order to register to vote, you have to prove who you are. In every state, and it's been this way pretty much forever, you have to bring in some sort of utility bill to show that you actually live there. You have to have some sort of ID that will satisfy a local resident. and very often they're volunteers, but sometimes they're, you know, county and state employees, whatever, that will satisfy them that you are who you say you are. And, you know, the states have been doing this for forever. I mean, they've been doing it since the founding of the Republic. And there's only one state that doesn't have voter registration. I think it's North Carolina or North Dakota, rather. You can just show up and vote. But even then, you know, you unless they know you, which is typically the case in small town North Dakota. But once you've registered to vote, you put your signature on file. And then when you come back, and I know this from when I was a kid, my mom was one of those women who worked the voting tables, you know, who volunteered to help people vote. And you'd come in and you then say your name and they'd look you up in the book and you would sign the book and they would pull out the signature, the original signature, the photograph out or photostat of it and compare them. And if it looked like your signature, then you could go vote. So that's the way we always did it. We never had a problem. And, you know, George W. Bush spent $74 million over a seven-year period, $94 million over a seven-year period funding a major search by federal prosecutors. 97 of the federal prosecutors were searching for, or 93 of the federal prosecutors, seven of them refused to do so, and he fired them, if you'll recall, that time that George W. Bush fired the seven federal prosecutors out of the 100 that we have nationwide. The 93 of them spent almost $100 million looking for voter fraud, looking for people who were pretending to be somebody that they weren't, people who did not have the legal right to vote, or people who were voting multiple times. And they were successful over that seven-year period of during the Bush administration. They were successful in prosecuting about 35 people.
Okay,
so and almost all of those 35 people that they busted were people who were felons in states where you lose your right to vote when even after you're off parole and didn't realize it. Because in some states, when you're off parole, you can go back to voting. And so basically, you know, voter fraud doesn't exist in the United States. Never really has.
Well, I don't believe that. Can I
sure.
tell you what happened November of 2012 when I went to vote?
Sure.
In the state of Michigan. I did not have to prove that I was who I said I was.
Right.
I could sign an affidavit saying, yep, I'm who I'm saying I am.
Right, and they would look at your signature and compare it with your original signature when you registered to vote.
They don't. Because if I went to a different precinct, then they don't have that on file. That's what I'm saying is people want to say that if you have to prove who you are, somehow disenfranchising you.
But Joe, if you vote illegally,
let me speak. I let you speak.
Well, no, I'm asking you a question here.
You're going to be just like Rush Limbaugh, and you're going
to. I'm trying to ask you a question, Joe. Calm down.
Well, but you're
here's a simple question.
And you cut me off.
I thought you made your point.
Last time I spoke, and you're going to do it right now.
I thought you'd made your point.
Well, no. You have to let me finish speaking to let me finish my point. You want to give your point.
Joe, if you're going to filibuster,
you know
we're going to end the conversation. Here's my simple question for you. It's a crime to commit voter fraud. It's a crime for you to go in there.
You're not going to let me speak.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm going to pot you down for a second and just ask you this question, and then I'll bring it back up and see if you want to answer it. If you go in and steal a candy bar, you can go to jail. If you vote illegally, you can go to jail. Given that, who in their right mind would vote illegally?
Feeling, then don't say you're free speech because you are not. You are not free speech. You're what your agenda and nothing else. I listen to you because I care to hear what somebody else says.
Yeah. Okay, so are you going
to
answer my question?
To hear what somebody else says. You want to put them down because they feel...
Can you answer my question, Joe?
That is the problem with my country, that I served 20 years in the military to preserve your right...
God bless
to
you,
the
Joe.
You are.
Can you answer my question?
What is your question?
If you go in and steal a candy bar from 7-Eleven, you go to jail. If you vote illegally, you go to jail. Who in their right mind is going to do either?
Okay. What happened in Ohio when the voting official just said they voted more than three times? Are they in jail?
Actually, yeah, that one guy, that one Republican who said that he was doing that, he was being prosecuted.
As bad as my mother-in-law, who is a Rush Limbaughite, every sentence you say is prefaced by the other party.
I haven't mentioned the Republican Party.
My country is because you don't give a damn. You want to have power.
I am not a politician, Joe. I don't have any
problem. But everything you preface that you disagree with is Republicans.
And I'm just saying that I don't think the voting fraud exists as a problem in this country.
It does.
Then why are people not being put in jail for it?
The Acorn thing when they were teaching people how to cheat.
Acorn, A, does no longer exists, and B, Acorn was the group that turned in the guy, James O'Keefe, who was soliciting voter fraud. They turned him in. They actually turned him in. Anyhow, we're out of time. Joe, thank you for the call. Thank you for the courtesy of the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. I realize in real life sometimes you can't pot somebody down. So, you know, back to the conversation. How do you talk to conservatives? The good, the bad, and the very, very stimulously ugly. The good. Lynn McDonald. Lynn is the mother of 7-year-old Grace, who was killed along with 19 other first graders in the Newtown shooting last December. She spoke at a gun violence conference today, calling on lawmakers to do something to make sure this tragedy doesn't happen again. McDonald said, "We ask our representatives to look into their hearts and remember the 26 beautiful lives we lost, and pass meaningful laws to help prevent this from happening again." This gun debate in America has a lot of voices. There are the voices of those brave Americans who've been affected by gun violence and are committing themselves to a cause so that no one else suffers like they have. And on the other side, there are the voices of Wayne LaPierre and the gun industry who just want more and more money, no matter how much blood is shed. Which side are you on? The bad. Republican Congressman Bob Goodlatte. This week, Goodlatte told NPR that he's not getting behind any immigration reform plan that includes any sort of pathway to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented immigrants currently in America. He said, "People have a pathway to citizenship right now. It's to abide by the immigration laws. But simply someone who broke the law came here to say, 'I'll give you citizenship now,' that I don't think is going to happen." End quote. That's an incoherent quote. Not too much of a surprise coming from a Republican, but Goodlatte is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, which means he's one of the central players in immigration reform. As Spider-Man's uncle said, with great power comes great responsibility. That means Goodlatte needs to act like a statesman, negotiate, and compromise to do what's best for the nation, and not act like Nutso, who attends John McCain's town hall meetings in Arizona on his free time. And the very, very ugly, Ron Kronenberger. He's a 53-year-old landlord in Warren County, Ohio, who's accused of whipping one of his tenants with a belt because the tenant was late on his rent. According to the police report, Kronenberger told his tenant, "You're going to act like a child, I'm going to treat you like one," then struck him 4 times on his butt, leaving behind marks. It makes sense that Kronenberger was the former Waynesville Chamber of Commerce president, given how corporate America has resorted to belittling and even vilifying the poor in America. Debtors' prisons are returning, and now rentiers like Kronenberger believe they can resort to corporal punishment to get their money. And that's very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
You enlighten me every day. We've been listening for many, many years. And your previous caller had the typical Michigan twang. I have many friends from there. I was born and raised there.
Hey, I was born in Grand Rapids. I grew up in Michigan. I love Michigan.
It's a great place, and that's what I called about in your first hour. It's sometimes very hard to listen to them when they are talking over you. So I have a strategy that I usually use when I'm debating someone that I know happens to be of the different party than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually don't debate them when they've had drinks, because you're never going to win when somebody's drinking.
It's a good idea.
And I write little crib notes. I let them speak. I let them say everything they're going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then I say, like I had a girlfriend that she's against Democrats because they're socialist.
Mm-hmm.
And I let her go and go and go. And I said, "You went to a public school?" And she says, "Yes." I said, "Probably been to a hospital with no insurance." And she said, says, yes. And I said, you've probably needed a police officer at some time in your life. She says, yes. I says, that's socialism. And I says, your veterans, how about your veterans? And she says, what do you mean? I says, they have some of the best socialistic medical care that you could ever have.
Yeah.
Try and take it away from them.
Well, not only that, I mean, the military is the most socialistic institution in the United States. The government pays for your housing, for your medical care, for your food, and even your clothing. That's socialism on steroids.
And your education.
Yeah, and of course your education. Yeah, good point. You have the luxury when you do that that I don't have here on the radio. It's like when I was talking to the caller from the Upper Peninsula, you know, I genuinely believed he had made his point, and I'm looking at the clock here, and I know that I've got, you know, at that point in time, I had a minute and about 40 seconds before we were going to hit that break, and I really wanted to ask him this question, and you know, I didn't want to go off into a discursion about whether or not I'm Rush Limbaugh. It really wasn't the topic, and so I ultimately decided to just step on him and put that question forward. Because of the time constraint, I mean, if I was sitting with him in a restaurant, I would, I think your strategy is brilliant. I, you know, just sit there and listen and let the guy talk himself out, and then respectfully say, okay, but here's the other side. So, Linda,
having your book around too also helps. I have bought a lot of copies of Screwed, and I hand them to friends, and I'm like, if I'm completely wrong, debunk this book.
That's great,
and they look at me.
Go ahead.
Like I'm crazy, but I'm like, debunk the book, because I says, you can't.
Thank
you. A lot of damage was done.
Well, before you said anything about the book, Shane had said to me, she's the person who's going to get a copy of Unequal Protection autographed by you. So I'm going to put you on hold, Linda. Linda's on line 9, and Danielle is going to pick you up and get your postal information so that we can send you a copy, compliments of stamps.com. Pat in Somerset, and thank you for the call, Linda. Pat in Somerset, Wisconsin. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Yeah, I actually start praying, but Tom, it's great. great talking to you again before. I'm calling to debunk that economics professor talking about the damage that's going to happen. I think he's probably a lobbyist, or he sounds like a lobbyist with the National Restaurant Association.
No, he's actually a college professor who believes in Milton Friedman and the Chicago School of Economics, which I think has been thoroughly debunked and disproven, particularly by the experiences of Chile and the former Soviet Union. But, you know, I'm guessing his argument would be it just wasn't done right. But who knows? But that's who he is.
Well, anyway, his rhetoric sounds just exactly what they preach at the National Restaurant Association. I've worked in the retail, the hospitality industry, which is hotels, restaurants, resorts.
Mm-hmm.
20 million employees, Tom. Over three-quarters of them depend on tips.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you this. It's debunked. They're on that rampage right now, the National Restaurant Association, through their state associations.
Right.
We got to stop this minimum wage increase. It goes on. I've seen this go on 40 times in my life, every time there's a proposal. And, in fact, in the restaurant industry, the only time employees ever get a pay raise is when they do raise the minimum wage, because they just turn them over and they just – but let me give you exactly – there are formulas. And I teach on the college – I'm a consultant today. I'm a market strategist. I've been on the show. Bernie Sanders and I were talking about this minimum wage the last time I was on the show with Bernie, asking him to get rid of tip credit.
Mm-hmm.
But there are formulas. I can tell you, if they raise the minimum wage right now from $7.25 to $9 an hour, and I speak as an expert, it will not. The cost of a Big Mac, for instance, will not go up more than 3 cents.
Right.
The cost of a meal in a fine dining restaurant will not go up more than about a dime. And there's formulas that prove this.
Sure, you know what percentage of the total cost of a product your labor costs are.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you take Walmart's, Tom. Walmart doesn't manufacture anything. At least restaurants do manufacture. They got to take a raw product. They got to cook it. They got to prepare it. You got to serve it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen at Walmart. You wait on yourself. The product is made someplace else. On a $10 product in Walmart, less than a nickel, the cost of that product will not go up. If it even goes up a nickel, it does not.
Right.
The other, if I could just add one more point, the tip credit. Here's the sad thing. Except
this is the Children's Health Insurance Program, right? CHIP?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tip credit, no, it's like $7.25 an hour. The minimum, I live right on the border here in Minnesota, Wisconsin. I'll give you an example. Apple, I consult to several major chain restaurants, including Applebee's, which have, you know, units in all states.
Mm-hmm.
The net profit at a Applebee's, for instance, and I'm not picking on them, whether it be Applebee's,
sure,
or
it's reflective of the industry. I got it.
Right. Where there's tipped employees. the net profit, even though Minnesota, there is no tip credit in Minnesota, there is no tip credit in Oregon. That's where if the minimum wage is $7.25, they can take the state minimum wage, which is Wisconsin. It's $2.31 an hour, Tom. It hasn't gone up in 34 years. And there's 42 other states that have that same minimum wage for tipped employees.
Right.
Minnesota, the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, as it is in Oregon, Washington,
right.
New York, and Nevada, and that's it. Five or six states.
Right.
The net profit on $1 million in sales is no less in Minnesota than it is in Wisconsin, and I'll tell you why. They are so many, being on the border here, there's people that drive from Wisconsin every day as many as 80 miles to work in a Minnesota restaurant because the difference between the $2.31 an hour in Wisconsin and the $7.25 an hour minimum wage for tipped employees in Minnesota, working a 40-hour week is over $800 a month. And I will debate this with anybody on the air, on your program, or anybody else. It is sad.
Mm-hmm.
Even though if they raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour, the minimum wage for the tipped employees in these states that allow tip credit,
mm-hmm.
and it's got to be the federal minimum wage. We've got to get rid of this tipped-in credit.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. These basically what they are exemptions from the minimum wage, and I could see an exemption from the minimum wage for people under 16 or working in a family business. John Boehner talks about how he started mopping the floors of his dad's bar when he was 10, that kind of thing, but I just don't get it why we would have a category of labor where we would say these people are basically going to be slave labor. These people are going to get lousy wages. And they do, by the way, they do this with farm labor as well. And so, Pat, thank you for a very articulate and clear exposition of the reality of the minimum wage. We need to raise it to $9 an hour. The president's right. It needs to be done right away because it needs to make up for the loss of stimulus in the economy, the lack of activity in the economy that's coming about as a consequence of that 2% raise or the end of the 2% cut to the Social Security tax.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour, and congratulations. Was it Pat who got unequal protection, as I recall? Yeah, it was. Congratulations. Thank you. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Howard in New York, New York. Hey, Howard.
Hey, hi. How are you?
Good.
I wanted to talk, most of the afternoon we've been talking about communications between people, mostly conservatives and liberals, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've read the book, Conservatives Without Conscience.
By John Dean. He's been on the program several times to talk about it. Yeah.
Ah, great. That's pretty pessimistic about talking with conservatives because it's essentially a brainwashing. But
to cut conservatives a break here, Howard, and John Dean would be the first to tell you this if he was on the program, what he was talking about was not that conservatives have no conscience, but that there is a subset of conservatives who are the a small subset at that, although they tend to rise to positions of power. I mean, he was speaking basically of Richard Nixon. People who have no conscience. They're sociopaths. And, there's this authoritarian personality that becomes leaders among these groups. And also there's authoritarians who become followers in those groups.
Right. And one of a couple of the studies that he based his book on, could be wrong, was, and I wonder if you were familiar with, one was the Milgram study.
Yeah, Stanley Milgram.
And which, if I remember,
progressively more intense electrical shocks until the person thinks that they're killing
the guinea pig or whoever's on the other side of the screen.
Yeah.
But the horrifying thing to me is they did it because an authority figure,
somebody
dressed up in a white coat,
right,
told them to keep going, and 65 or 70%. Shocked that person to death. I mean, that's a horrifying number.
Yeah.
And then one other study. Do you remember the Zimbardo study?
That one I don't remember.
Okay, that was in Stanford, and what they did was they took colleagues and students. I don't remember what grade they were in, and they made five of them. They were peers. Five of them became jailers, and the other five became prisoners.
Oh, yeah. I am familiar with that study, yeah. And the jailers became brutal, and the prisoners became docile.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he had to stop the study after 3 days as opposed to the schedule five.
Yeah.
I mean, all of which makes me incredibly pessimistic about people, you know, playing well with others or even communicating.
Well, and let me point out, Howard, this is not unique to conservatives, although John Dean's book was about conservatives without a conscience. There is also an authoritarian strain on the left. And you find this particularly among people who call themselves anarchists or call themselves communists, and every sentence begins with "everybody must" or "if only everybody would." And you know, I've encountered these folks in my life. Go ahead.
Fringe groups on both sides.
Yeah, there are fringe groups on both sides, and there are sociopaths on both sides. And I think that we all need to acknowledge that, so it doesn't just become name calling. Although the authoritarian personality does tend more to attract people who call themselves conservatives, but that in and of itself may or may not be a personality disorder. You could argue that that's actually a good thing in society, gives you a more well-ordered society. That would be the argument that William F. Buckley would make. So, Howard, thank you for the call. Interesting point. Paul in Denison, Texas. Hey, Paul. First, do no harm.
How are you doing?
You
there?
Yeah, I am. You said first do no harm?
Right. I'm sure you're familiar with that ethic. It's the first ethic of medical theory.
Yes, the Hippocratic Oath.
Doctor. Exactly. What I'm going to stipulate is I think that you would agree that we're on the verge of a progressive revolution in this country. And I think that the core problem in our economic and governmental theory is that we allow the profit motive to exist without any caveat. And I think that the progressive change that we should be aiming for, and I agree with Move to Amend, and I agree with many progressive organizations right now, but I think that they're only teetering on the edges, and they're not addressing any fundamental change in our society. And I think that if we were to incorporate the primum non nocere into our economic theory as well as our governmental theory, and I think it's already in our governmental theory. I mean, that's the purpose of law itself, is to do no harm. So that's my stipulation, is that we need to amend corporate law so that the profit motive is secondary to primum non nocere.
First, do no harm. Paul, I absolutely agree with you, and so does Adam Smith. Everybody loves to talk about Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, but that, in my opinion, was not his most important book. His most important book was titled A Theory of Moral Sentiments, and it's equally dense reading, although you can find excerpts of it online. Be sure you don't get them off the right-wing sites, because they tend to redact or pull them out of context. But Adam Smith's premise was, in short form, that capitalism needs to be constrained by the moral force of society in order to function to the benefit of society. That the reason why we as a society would create capitalism, because it is a societal invention, it's an artifice rather, it's an artificial creation, a conceptual thing. The reason that we do this is because we believe that there is more of a benefit to society at the end of the day than there is harm to society, even though there are harms inherent in capitalism and in all forms of business. And so the debate always is, or the challenge for government, since government is the arbiter of the rules, government establishes the rule books, particularly a government of, by, and for the people. And keep in mind, when Adam Smith wrote this, the American experiment was just beginning. And Adam Smith, of course, was either British or Scottish. But this idea that the obligation of government was to figure out what is the best way to make sure that the harm of capitalism is minimized. And I would say that has been lost largely since the Reagan era, when, Reagan came in and said, no, government shouldn't play a role in deciding these things.
Well, how do you propose we address that? I mean,
I think we need to just repudiate Reaganism and say, no, government actually does have a job to do and why? Because we elected it. I mean, this is what, George Washington and, fought the Revolutionary War for, was self-governance. And, as Franklin Roosevelt said, against mob rule and the overprivileged alike. So, on both sides of the coin. Paul, excellent point. Thanks for the call, and appreciate your calling in. today. Coming up tomorrow on our program, we'll have a conversation with Senator Sherrod Brown about national manufacturing centers. And It's Anything Goes on Town Hall Friday, your chance to let us know what's on your mind and the best of the rest of the news. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.